Hooray, hurrah! Once again, the smartest man in the world, Proopcast, takes to the ether, this time from the salubrious confines of the patio of Proopitude, located just off the fortress of Proopitude. It's an adjunct area, and yet we've been designated use for it tonight by the Proops Park Police. And by their graces, we're here. Happy International Ladies' Day, and happy... what did Doug Benson call it? National Ladies' Day. International Women's Day, and of course, it's Women's History Month. And I wish you a happy both of them, Jennifer.
Well, gee, thanks.
You're welcome. That's Mary J. Blige, and we're playing it for two reasons. One, she's bad to the bone. And two, this was Kamala's walkout music.
It was indeed.
Kamala walked out to this all during the election, and Kamala had a big historic moment today when she was in the White House with President Biden, and he tweeted something, and it's such a pleasure to say the president tweeted something, and it's the most wonderful thing you could tweet. Obviously, the Rescue Act is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened. We'll get to that. He wrote, "I want every child to know that this is what vice presidents and generals in the United States Armed Forces look like." And it's him mm-hmm. with two women that mm-hmm. have just joined the generalship.
And our vice president.
And our vice president, Kamala.
The two women were denied becoming four-star generals by the previous Traitor administration. And they were kept waiting for this until Biden, of course, mm-hmm. Was willing to put them forward. And he said, "We need little girls and boys, both, who have grown up dreaming of serving for their country to know what this is what generals in the United States Armed Forces look like." And they're both, as Vice President Harris called them, the best of the best, and noted the short time that women have been able to officially hold combat roles. While it's only been 5 years since all combat jobs have opened to women, women have been in the line of fire risking their lives to protect our nation long before that. And to see all of them standing there.
What are their names? I can't see that well. One of them's Richardson, and one of them's...
Army Lieutenant General Laura Richardson and Air Force General Jacqueline Van Ava.
Wow. Yeah, and Lloyd Austin is standing there.
Right, our Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who's towering over everyone.
And also African-American. It's a very exciting moment in history because we're seeing, and this is what blows me away, and I'm sure you too, what's basically been going on that tried to reverse the 60s, Reaganism, Nixonism, Bushism, and the thing that happened before, seditionism. By the way, they're sponsored now by the new Ford Sedition, when you have to take over the government by violent overthrow because you don't have a plurality of votes. Is that all at once, justice is being served in a big teacup, and
well, there,
changes.
He and Vice President Harris aren't just undoing the traitor executive orders and his nefarious acts, but they're actually moving at a faster pace and getting more done than so many administrations. I mean, I can't think of anything since LBJ.
No, that's just supercharged.
It's only been 48 days.
Yeah.
And he had set himself a goal, President Biden, of getting 100 million vaccinations in 100 days.
Right, the GOP's was to get 100 vaccinations in 100 million days.
and we're already more than halfway there.
Isn't that wild? Well, that's what happens when the grown-ups take charge. Also, nothing escapes...
Sorry, we're not more than halfway there. We're already to 90 million.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Of the 100 million goal.
This is Women's History Month. And on International Women's Day... he has signed an executive orders establishing a gender policy council and directing the Department of Education to review the Title IX laws. Because Betsy DeVos, as you know, her interest in sexual predators was to cosset them, protect them, and give them warm quilts to hide
in. Wasn't it?
And so that's going to be reviewed and discussed and taken apart. Also, the gender policy council is going to look at so many things. Combating systemic bias and sexual demonstration or discrimination when you demonstrate, and sexual harassment, inequality, the pandemic's kicking women in the butt. Well, this is really going to go a long way, I think.
Kamala Harris wrote a column for the Washington Post last month about how the pandemic had forced 2.5 million women out of the workforce, and mainly women of color.
Right. They have to go back home and they lose their jobs. They have to go home and take care of people.
Well, not just that. They lost their jobs.
Because they lost their jobs. Because their jobs are the first to go.
Yeah. And so part of the American Rescue Plan and part of this what is it called? The Equality?
No, well, it's going to be the Gender Policy Council.
Is to rectify that.
Oh, very much so. They're going to make recommendations. They'll have power to do things. You'll see Title IX restored, I think, almost fully under this administration. Also, we're very close on Deb Haaland, are we not, for Interior right
yes.
now? Speaking of history.
In the column, Harris says that she cast her first tie-breaking vote in the Senate to advance this plan.
Awesome.
To help women who have been forced out of the workforce. She's now tied with Thomas Jefferson for a number of vice presidential tiebreakers.
Wow. TJ had the most?
No, not the most. She's in the middle.
Ah.
But she's tied
rising
with
up the list, yes.
Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson, famous proponent of liberty and famous slave owner.
Yeah.
Famous enslaver of black people. Mm.
She's also playing an unusually large role in shaping Biden's foreign policy. There's an article about that in the Washington Post. Just today, she was on the phone. She's making calls independent of Biden.
Yeah.
She was on the phone with the Prime Minister of Norway, who is also a woman.
Yes.
And it's really exciting to see our first woman vice president being given this spotlight and independence.
Also, the assurance, right? That she is the last one that he talks to all the time
yeah.
about everything.
Yeah.
So I really feel like everything's a team effort here. I don't think anybody goes into anything. I mean, I think he reserves the right to disagree with her, which Obama did with Biden. But I think at the end of the day, he's taking on her counsel as hard as humanly possible. The reason he brought her there is because he thinks she's the best person. And everyone in the cabinet's an all-star. You know, New Yorkers and he was able to Neera Tanden's going to get in anyway into the White House and have a staff.
She's going to be appointed to a position.
So we kind of won that one too.
Representative Marcia Fudge, I think her hearings are coming up for housing and urban development.
And Merrick Garland might be in by the time this comes out, I think, right?
Yeah, the vote is tomorrow afternoon.
Well, then it'll be when you're listening to this.
Which is just... Yeah.
Time will have stopped still and gone backwards to Schnooze Day from Sneeze Day because we're recording it tonight on the Tuesday, and then when the time this drops, we're hoping Merrick Garland is in control of the Justice Department.
Also, Mayorkas is already making changes to the Department of Homeland Security, making it a humane department,
Ooh.
Which is something
new. Yes, we're starting to look after the people that we have in detention. And I think it's going to be a long, complicated process. They've also put 100 families together, is it?
Yes.
Out of the hundreds that are separated. It's impossible to talk about this without the inhumanity sinking in every second. And the thing I'd like to say is, look how humane these people are. They inherited literally a burning wagon
mm-hmm.
of refuse
mm-hmm.
careening off a cliff. And in 48 days, as you point out, they haven't righted it, but they're making so much huge, bold moves. And we haven't even got to the rescue plan. But just the idea that the Homeland Security is run by someone who wants to look after people. We want to allow a more humane way of them getting into the country. Oh, Venezuelans are going to be allowed because their government is scary and unstable right now, and they're under threat.
The fact that they're saying that the children that were separated from their families that they can choose to be met with their families either in the country that the parents are in or our country.
Right.
There's more. You know, it couldn't have been worse, the conditions they were in.
Oh, no.
And now they're in safe spaces, safer spaces. The rescue plan, Senator Schatz from Hawaii, posted that it even has provisions for Native Hawaiians. These are all unthinkable under the last administration. Ruth Hopkins, who's a Dakota Lakota Sioux writer and editor, she wrote the other day that since Biden's been in office, he stopped the Keystone Pipeline. Mm-hmm. He's issued an executive order reinstating tribal consultation, put a pause on the mining of Sacred Oak Flat, nominated Native Deb Haaland for Interior Secretary, and pushed for COVID relief for tribes.
Well, I think you meant Native American.
I was just quoting her.
Oh, she said Native Deb Haaland.
Yes. Yes, indeed, the rescue plan has an extensive plan to help the Native American population.
And how thoughtful, and what a complete turnaround from the abuse everybody was getting from the last group of seditionists. You know, it's just that putting in things that are provisions for Native Americans, there's so much in this. It's a giant cracking whack at child poverty.
It's huge. It will lift so many children out of poverty. As Hillary Clinton wrote, it's one of the most ambitious pieces of legislation in a generation. It will materially help families in dire need. It will cut child poverty in half. And Senator Sherrod Brown said, this is the best day I've had in the Senate when they voted for it.
Isn't that great? Well, it's going to get passed. By the time the show's on, I suspect he'll sign it, or he'll sign it the day after. Or maybe he'll sign it right away, I suppose. In any case, it's an earthquake. It's a cataclysm. Nothing's happened like this literally since 1965 that I can remember, when the Great Society, the Voting Rights Act, Miranda, all those things went through in 1 year.
Right.
LBJ was main goal was to fight poverty in the United States and have children have enough to eat. And that hasn't been a goal in a long time, you might have noticed. That's disappeared from the agenda. As far as the GOP goes, they have nothing. They were talking about literally Dr. Seuss, Pepe Le Pew, and what was it, Mr. Potato Head's junk? That was what they were talking about this week, because they don't have anything.
Do you consider those important fixations?
I had a Mr. Potato Head, and when it first came as a toy, there was not the plastic one inside. You got your mother to give you a potato, and you could stick it. And by the way, they were sharp.
What?
It had eyes and ears, a sharp ass, and the little legs that it would stand on, right? And the little things that you put in it were super pointy. And then, of course, it would sit around too long, and it would start to turn, or it would, like potatoes do, they just potato out. And
seriously?
All of a sudden, yeah. And then they started giving you the plastic one. But the plastic one wasn't as fun, because you could fuck up a potato by putting the face down there and the feet up. You know what I mean? It was funnier. What I'm getting at is they don't have any plan, and they don't have any idea of helping people at all. Their big, big, big overarching, overriding plan is to shed themselves of every so-called moderate Republican, the ones who could read books, and put in this insane QAnon white nationalist branch, and therefore squeeze the party to represent nobody, and then it'll have to contract massively. Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton aren't taking the party forward anywhere. They're only going to quine and create white grievance and create these imaginary things that the Rescue Act is frivolous or haphazard or
liberal
agenda. Right.
Their victimization is imaginary.
But 80% of the public wants this. So they're fighting a fight against nothing. It's just literally they have nothing but owning libs and making up stupid things. That's not policy. It's not even politics, really. It's just sort of, you see what an aggressive delaying tactic looks like, and
well, there's grifting, and there's
it's all a grift.
Yeah, screaming and yelling.
And then, you know, just the fact that they feel like it's okay to not help anybody during this and let everything just sort it out, because they think with gerrymandering and white supremacy they're going to carry the day again or whatever. But it's a really crappy plan.
Right. They're really fixated on stripping voting rights from people
who aren't white people.
And then we look at the result of LaTosha Brown and Stacey Abrams and other organizers in Georgia. We have two new Democrat senators who were awesome and were able to vote on this American
Rescue. It wouldn't have happened without them winning Georgia. And that wouldn't have been, that's on Latosha Brown and Stacey, a lot of people, but them chiefly for really, really organizing. And I think the answer to all the stupid gerrymandering cases, they're not stupid, all the terrible gerrymandering cases, Mark Elias is going to fight a bunch of them. A lot of people are going to fight them at other states, and they'll go, a bunch will go to the Supreme Court.
It's also the laws. They're trying to make it more complicated to vote.
People will find a way to get around it. There'll be a way to do this. I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna. All of the gerrymandering laws and all the state laws have to be fought viciously and tooth and nail. Oh, Arizona's trying to push one through. Like, you don't have to count the presidential vote if it didn't go the way you want it or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like a cereal box.
Yeah.
Of nonsense. And really, really white supremacy writ large. Just writ large. Well, it couldn't be written any larger.
And they just want to wear people down. And we have to remember there's an election this month. Mm-hmm. At the end of the month, there's elections next year.
Yeah.
It never stops. And we have to be prepared and you have to vet your candidates.
This is a pedal in the metal time because if this is their plan to just disenfranchise voters and roll the dice on that, as we were discussing before, mail-in ballots are something old people quite like to use, and their constituency tends to skew a tad older. Mm-hmm. So I'm not real sure. Oh, and by the way, I'm 45 sedition voted by mail. So they, you know, I don't know that the plan is the most well thought out. This is kind of a Wile E. Coyote, you know, I've got a diagram here.
The economic anxiety of people that support a man who lives at a country club.
Yeah. Not just a country club, a ratty one.
Yeah.
Have I told the Trump Tower story? I mean, not to the Trump Tower story, the Trump Atlantic City story?
I think you have.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, we were playing here at the Trump Hotel in like 2004. Me, Drew, Brad, and Colin. We were there 1 year, the next year. That was 2006 because I flew back from Germany at the World Cup. And the state of New Jersey had closed down because of a tax dispute, and the casino was closed. And we walked through a black casino to our showroom, and we were in the dressing room, sitting there. And there was no one in the place, just security guards in the place, yellowed, roped off. And the casino entertainment director came in, Guido McMorganized Crime, and went, "Hey, don't mention it. If you don't mention that the casino's closed, no one will notice." Boom, bang, right? And we were like, "What?" I go, "There's never been a more depressing sight in the history of mankind." I mean, honestly, it was morbid. And the sword of Damocles was hanging over the room. So, of course, we came out and went, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and what happens in Atlantic City comes to a grinding fucking halt. But they gave us this room. And in the room, I had a table. If I had a table, I'd set it with divine stuff. I had a table, and on it was this crap tablecloth. And I leaned on the table or put something on the table, and it folded outright. It folded to the floor. The table fell off. The top of the table fell off. And then I realized when I picked this burning mess up that it was two pieces of pasteboard that had been snanked together like that. And that was what was holding up the tabletop. So as soon as you put any pressure on it.
Like what you would set up for a day of catering rather than a...
You wouldn't even...
Put it in a hotel.
It smelled like organized crime because it fell so easily.
Well, isn't this the casino that was imploded?
It wasn't a table. It wasn't a table with legs. It was three pieces of pasteboard.
Wasn't this the one that they destroyed a couple weeks ago? That was fun to watch over and over again.
It was great. And we played Atlantic City a year before and... our hotel was down the road from it, and we asked everybody about it at our hotel because we played a nice big new one that had good food and stuff. No, not Chinese food, breakfast. And more mooks than you could shake a stick at. Atlantic City is the mook. If you like, Jennifer, if you like guys wearing baseball hats calling each other Vinny, you're going to have the best time at the casino. Oh, and leaving beer in the hallway. Anyway, our casino was nice and new.
Another Vinny.
Right. We asked as many Vinnies as you can handle there. Hey, hold up. We're all going down. We're going to get a beer. You know, you're like, all right. About Trump Casino. And they're all like, it just was the worst. It was a drag. It folded. No one liked it. It was cheap. I leaned against the wall there while I was watching some lounge act. Like, just casually leaned back. Not even, like, for support on a wall, but just sort of leaned back. And it was plastic that was shaped to look like a light fixture, and it went, boom, boom. I mean, it was the place. I don't know how it stayed up. And if that's how all of his buildings, if that's the kind of low bid mafia contracting that he's doing everywhere, and then he doesn't pay those guys. He cheaps them, and then he doesn't pay them. And then they blow the place up. And
Sort of like how he's trying to bypass the Republican Party and ask people to donate directly to him.
That's hilarious.
That's going to work out well
for everybody.
Oh, he's
going to have an infomercial on OAN coming up. You remember me. I live in Florida now, and I need your help. Do you hate everyone who's not like you? Me too. He's in a world of hurt. The New York AG is going after him. They've got all the books.
They've got the financials.
Yeah, he's being confronted on a million levels. The AG of Georgia is Ms. Willis, Lawyer Willis, Attorney General Willis, the first black woman Attorney General in Georgia, is going to go after him on racketeering charges for the call he made to Raffensperger to say if he could find enough votes. And then there was a subsequent call to the governor.
Both she and Attorney General James in New York have enlisted the support of lawyers who are specifically RICO.
The one they brought in Georgia is heavy. Floyd, that guy Floyd, he's heavy. They talked about a conviction they got about in 2015 or whatever, and he said it was the longest, toughest case of his life, and they put a bunch of them behind bars, and that was for like a school payoff scandal. And this one is, they have him on tape saying, I need you to find, and he says 11,000, whatever, there's an exact amount of votes.
I need.
Right.
What was the Lenny Bruce routine?
Yeah.
I'd like 70 erasers and.
Yeah, let me have three Big Chief tablets and 400 tubes of airplane glue. Put it on the rag and away now. Good morning, Mr. Chandler. Yeah, let me have Action Comics.
I need 11,000 votes.
Give me a comb, and I need 11,475 votes. He's in trouble all over the place, and good. And also the seditionists are being run to ground by the FBI one by one by one by one. One guy went to Kenya, and you could imagine what he looked like. He looked like all the rest of them. You know, the hat and the beard and everything. And like, you're going to...
And possible Kenya, neck beard.
Kenya, much to their awesome credit, because as you know, Africa was mistreated rudely the last 4 years. We're just coming back on that. Banning Nigeria for travel here when they're like the most powerful ally. You know, what? They tossed his ass and he was picked up at the airport. So they're collecting them. If you see them on Twitter and stuff and you know one of them, feel free to turn them in. You're really doing yourself a patriotic duty here. There's going to be so many trials, and this is going to go on for a while.
Mark Pitcavage at the ADL said that they're arresting them every day.
Yeah.
Which is good news.
Oh, yes, it is. And don't forget that Stone and Jones, and I mean Roger Stone and Alex Jones, not the comedy team of Stone and Jones, because they were fomenting sedition, because they were there on the day, and because of all the horrible, horrible things they did, the Justice Department's going after them to find out what's going on. And also, let's be honest, you watched Josh Hawley in front of Christopher Wray from the FBI last week and his line of questioning. So if you find a phone, and there's like information leading to, you know, anyway, say there's a phone and it's monogrammed and it has a case that says JH on it. If you were to look at that phone, would
it,
you
it
be
really
able?
It really did sound like that.
The way he was asking the questions was finally Chris Ray was like, well, we do
so
that with all the phones.
So if you're in room 204 and you're calling someone in Colorado.
Say I was in the halls of Congress and I was texting someone quite near the stand that day. Yeah, someone wearing a fur mankini and a Viking helmet, say. Someone that called themselves the Shaman. No, I think that he was worried. And I mean, he's so stupid.
Good.
He's so stupid and egregious that he openly displayed it at the hearing by taking a line of questioning that directly implicated himself because he was known on the day to be openly supportive of them. And him and Cruz, their behavior before the count when they gave their little speeches was some of the most vile demagoguery that pettifoggery that's ever been foisted. You'll have to go to 19th century terms. It's so bad.
Is Pence still couch surfing in the witness non-protection? My understanding is
he's at the, there's a Shake Shack in, a Shake and Steak in French Lick, Indiana.
Not a Cracker Barrel?
Yeah, right, because they have more exclusive porch policies there with their, well, who can sit on the furniture. Cracker Barrels are hilarious. They're almost Dinesian in their racism for so long, and yet people flock to them. The food is okay. I've eaten in Cracker Barrels from Michigan to the deep. In the deep south, I prefer like a Waffle House or a down-home place,
yeah.
a diner. Diners are the best in the south because, and so many.
Does Jackson, Mississippi have water yet?
No, and that governor. You know, he's big thing in the middle of Jackson not having water. By the way, Jackson's the biggest city in Mississippi. It has 300,000 people, which is a lot in Mississippi. They don't have metropolises.
And it's over 80% black.
Yes, and their mayor is Chakwe Lumumbe, a young black man. And
whose father was a famous activist.
Yeah.
Mayor for a short time.
They haven't been able to get the water back on, but Tate Reeves decided to open up the state again, even though their infection rate is disastrous.
Didn't he...
He followed one day after...
Yeah, after Biden called him.
Yeah. Well, Texas opened up because Abbott and Patrick there want everyone dead. I think the Texas AG better get some running shoes, too, because his little activities running around the country and fomenting this whole thing were pretty shocking.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's move on to the awesome part is all those things are happening, and crime does not pay. Yeah, they got away with it a lot. Are they going to continue to get away with it? Sometimes. You're not going to win everything. And voting rights may be drastically altered, so we have to stand too all the time. But I think no more sniveling because things are happening not just fast, but lightning fast. This week, it's going to – the rescue plan gets signed. Next week, money. Next week.
Right.
I mean, the rollout's huge, so it's going to take a while.
Tomorrow, Merrick Garland. I mean – we'll finally have
a working justice
the team that we need. They put forward a woman of South Asian descent who was a civil rights attorney.
Ms. Gupta?
Yeah, to be the assistant to the AG.
Yeah.
Which is, she's the first one
mm-hmm.
to be...
A lot of hot position. South Asian action going around in this administration.
No, but I meant also the first civil rights attorney.
Yeah. Just awesome. Well, civil rights is back. See, we're going to have a civil rights division now. We're going to have a part of the
representation.
We're going to have a part of the government that actually chases down white supremacists, which they had literally stopped doing
yes.
altogether.
Yes.
Oh, and Elaine Chao's good. There'll be an Inspector General investigation into Elaine Chao's. Inconceivably, she played the place like it was a casino. She literally had deals going with her dad. Her dad picked up. She was spending money. Running games on everybody, ordering her staff to do her personal things, as well as funneling money to all of her friends. It's pretty shocking.
There are no rules, no boundaries.
Oh, no.
And no ethics.
Because all IGs have been dismantled. He stopped any sort of internal review. So that'll come to the fruition, too, which is why I think Admiral Akbar, the cave salamander from Kentucky, I don't think he makes it. I think he tries to get through his crappy, the governor can't pick the next senator thing, and then he bunks out.
Reading about him voting for Garland today, after denying Garland a seat on the Supreme Court.
For 10 months. How about those apples? His necrotic hands fumbling for the voting stick. Purplish, gray, his leathery skin, his slate gray shell.
Oh, he's alluring.
Coursing through the night. Oh, isn't he just? Who
you can
wouldn't
see
want
why,
to take orders from
why
him?
Why people vote for him.
Yep.
It's just so awesome. This week, NASA named the spot where Perseverance touched down after Octavia Butler.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, it is. And a spokesperson for NASA said, her protagonists embodied determination and inventiveness, making her a perfect fit for the Perseverance rover mission and its theme of overcoming challenges, said Catherine Stack Morgan, the deputy project scientist. Butler inspired and influenced the planetary science community and many beyond, including those typically underrepresented represented in STEM fields. I can think of no better person to mark this historic landing site than Octavia E. Butler, who not only grew up next door to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory mm-hmm. in Pasadena, but she also inspired millions with her visions of a science-based future. Her guiding principle when using science, do so accurately, is what the science team at NASA is all about. Her work continues to inspire today's scientists and engineers across the globe, all in the name of a bolder, more equitable future for all. Isn't that great?
You know, taking African-American author's name and naming a place on Mars is just the sweetest.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It feels good. And also what she stood for, and it's a shame she couldn't see it, because she'd be pretty chuffed,
yes.
I think.
Yes, she well chuffed. Left this planet in 2006.
Yeah, and but I mean, when you think about, again, I don't want to dwell, but it's so different and so refreshing and good to see truth and justice back in this on the menu, instead of vituperation and desolation and despair and anger and rage and everything being force-fed and, oh, my God, I'm being hard done by. Why can't I lash out? Why can't I lash out?
Well, and to try to disappear the great and the good.
Oh.
Talk about turnaround. Our governor, Gavin Newsom, before California was way behind in vaccinations, now we're sixth in the world after India.
It's a calamari comeback, Jennifer.
Isn't it?
No, he's had rough go, baby. And, you know, these white supremacists and tech bros in the state want to recall him. And it's a big waste of everyone's time. It's a load of old wank.
It's horrible to have that be to try to steal focus during everything that people have gone through in the state.
Oh, my God. And, you know, I know you guys, a lot of you guys are listening in Luxembourg and Liechtenstein and other places. And
San Marino.
Right, San Marino. And, of course, the Antilles. I think we have one person in the Antilles, Aruba, whatnot. I know when you're listening from outside, you think, well, he's messed it up, didn't he? Didn't he and Garcetti mess it up? You have to remember that Newsom was forced to grovel to get literally anything from 45.
During the fires.
And that, yeah. And then, you know, for the whole of COVID, they would have those weekly governor things where he would berate everybody. And Newsom somehow slid onto the good side for a while. But we weren't getting anywhere near what we needed, of course.
No.
And then there was no help.
No, he wanted to punish California because we didn't vote.
And then you told me that Garcetti said that he had not gotten a call for the whole of the crisis.
Yes, he said that.
He's our mayor here, and he has a lot to deal with because L.A. is bloody huge.
Also, people just never – I mean, I didn't know it until I looked it up, but the way it's set up here, the Los Angeles mayor has less power over the city of Los Angeles than the San Francisco mayor, for instance, has over
right.
San Francisco.
The San Francisco mayor actually has a lot more power.
Why it varies so much from city to city, major cities. I mean, I understand smaller cities, but it seems like LA is one of the largest. For him to not have that much power over other more powerful, like the police union,
well, I was gonna say,
or the board of supervisors, or
they made it that way because
the
I think
county, the,
it's been
is,
such a free for all here for 70 years, you know.
Reading about what Los Angeles was like during the last pandemic,
yeah.
Oh my God, there were so many tunnels downtown because they were hiding booze mm-hmm. during Prohibition and. The mayor then was in on it.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps, we're a lot luckier.
Perhaps explaining why now the mayor doesn't.
Well,
have
I was
so
just going to say, you're writing your own script here because it was a total free for all there.
Yeah,
and the
was
prohibition was
wild.
The police were bombing, like hiding bombers, helping bombers.
Yes.
I mean, this town
there was.
There
was a whole spate of car bombings.
God, yes. Completely.
In the 20s.
And the brutality against the Latin community and the black community here and the redlining. Like
and
this
the
place
Native
is,
American community.
Oh, well, LA is like open city, you know. And so I think that's kind of why the mayor, also the law enforcement unions, let's face it, they got the ball. They basically made it.
What about the founders of downtown LA that were largely black Mexicans?
Yeah, that's new news, right? You don't read about that as much as you might in history.
You don't really hear about that as much as you might.
I was just going to say, we have a lot of people here in LA, 8-10 million, and the California's got, what, 40 million? So if it seems like they're not doing enough, you have to. We're turning a ship here in the middle of the ocean. And it's for them to any like literally we were all in complete purple panic in December and January here.
Yes.
Like we didn't, you know, we try to keep a peppy outlook, but it was really shocking how much the hospitals were literally at the breaking point for a month and a half. And it was horrible.
Yeah. Some of the more affluent places like Beverly Hills were acting as though the mayor was punishing them unnecessarily or exaggerating how bad it was.
Well, we see maskless dingwads all over Los Angeles, but yes, it's much better than it was. And Beverly Hills is always, they've got that rich victim thing going on. You know, that's where they were letting him have the weird 45 rallies and then and they were total spreaders, you know. Every mm-hmm. time we mm-hmm. you saw them or we drove by one horribly, no one's got a mask, everyone's shouting. And they all look like they've been kitted out by some expensive gear store.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ragtag.
Right, Identikit.
Oh, no, the red and hats and the printed signs and the, you know, everything, you know, kitted out, geared out. You don't see a lot of handwritten signs at his things.
No. Huh.
My favorite thing, Jennifer, was at CPAC, the weird Munsters convention they had, where they all got up and screamed, and then he got up and went, "Hi, the amount of between him, Larry Kudlow,
the golden Bob's Big Boy,
right?
The statue of
the that was it on wheels or was it? Did it actually move?
It was made in Mexico.
Oh, awesome! Hecho in Mexico. Fantastic. The golden calf on Bob's Big Boy on Wheels was a real stellar moment for ex-presidents or ex-seditionists, let's say. But they all got up, Don Jr. and Kudlow and him, and they were all absolutely monstrously inebriated mm-hmm. and in their own special ways. But I read an article about the CPAC and the guy. They were really trying to whip up, you know, the Hillary shirts always killed, the Kamala shirts killed, right? Nancy, they can always get a good Nancy one out. And they sell loads of gear there. That's the whole thing. It's everything's a grift with them, so the souvenirs are big. And the guy said, "I'm taking all the Biden stuff home. I can't give it away." So they'd made up shirts that say "Sleepy Joe," or "Where's Joe Hiding?" and shit like that. And everybody just walks by them, even at the CPAC, where people, you know, people think Ben Shapiro's or Charlie Kirk is cute. People who think Tomi Lahren is.
How about the journalists really doing a bang up job by asking about Major the dog?
That was pretty sad. Major seems to be a highlight for everybody because we've had a person who literally we know was cruel to animals,
right.
Children and women.
Yep.
And now we've got someone who loves his dogs and loves his family.
But no, instead of asking questions about all the profound change, doubling down on, we want to hate something, so now we're going to hate your dog.
Well, the dog bit one of the Secret Service guys, but it didn't break the skin.
Nipped him.
And it's a young dog, right?
It's a 3-year-old dog.
Oh, okay.
He's a rescue dog.
Right, so he's feisty. Oh, yeah, they made a big thing out of it, and then one of the reporters today said, "Is he going to be euthanized on TV?" And I was like, well, that's sweet. This is a clip you want to go viral.
Jen Psaki said, he's part of the family.
Yeah.
So, no, that's not happening.
But, I mean, 500,000 people lost their lives because the GOP refused to organize or lift a finger. Countries like Ghana and Taiwan, South Korea, New Zealand, a whole bunch of countries in Africa have way better infection rates than even any state here. Because South Dakota is like, would be a worldwide spreader, right? And they had the ball and they had everything in their hands to do it, and they didn't because I can only presume they're seditious traitors.
Mm-hmm.
There couldn't have been a plan to just not do anything and then hope it would all work out for the best, because killing 500,000 people to me seems like a much more odious thing than Major nipping the guy or whatever and then having to go to the word euthanize.
Yeah, let's compare and contrast. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, if we're going to both sides everything, let's both sides everything. You get clear, concise, accurate answers from Jen Psaki. And if she doesn't know the answer, she says, let me circle back on that. And the next day,
mm-hmm.
because her and her staff meet, they present the president with the questions.
And she answers.
Yes. Instead of going, and I mean, the standards are so low that I think the reporters are, one, entranced by the violence they've been through has convince them that there's only one way to follow a story now. And also that insistence always that Democrats are held to some insane standard and Republicans are allowed to be people like Dick Cheney, W., Bill Barr, mm-hmm. they're allowed to be that Jared Kushner, mm-hmm. Larry Kudlow, that none of them should be near the handles of government.
No.
Bannon, Steve Bannon was in our government.
They shouldn't be allowed to drive a car.
Mike Flynn.
Another really inspiring thing that happened is the PRO Act, which will help. It ensures workers can stand together and negotiate for higher wages, better benefits, and safer working conditions. It really encourages unionization. And the other day,
I am going to close down some comedy clubs.
It made a big impact in Alabama, where Amazon warehouse workers have been trying to organize. Mm-hmm. And Biden came out in support of them.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, we haven't had a pro-union president like this since the 60s. And I mean the 60s. I mean,
right?
It's just
Johnson.
Astonishing how pro-union he is. I belong to two unions, which merged into one union. And I know I don't belong to AGRA or ACTRA.
And as a sidebar to the Amazon story, Jeff Bezos' ex-wife, Mackenzie Scott, has remarried. She married a high school science teacher, and he has pledged to work with her in giving away most of her money.
She has an ungodly fortune, too, right?
She's given so much to charity.
It's great. I haven't enjoyed that divorce so much in a million years. Because Bezos is like, wow, tight with a buck. And he really doesn't want to improve the working conditions for the peeps. They have hard-ass schedules and work long hours, and the conditions aren't that great. And when they do internal reviews like they did a couple months ago, we talked about it on the show, he gave himself high marks.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's not how you do it. This is how Facebook and these companies operate that way, where the maha just...
Or if you're Google, you just get rid of your ethics department.
Right. Like the Republican Party. We get rid of the... No more morality equals... and our reality is our reality. But you know what? He's going to have to fold at a certain point, too, and improve things, I think.
Yeah.
Just as a gesture, if nothing else.
And speaking of improving things, I found the quote about DHS Secretary Mayorkas announcing that the Biden administration's task force for reuniting migrant families separated by the last administration will allow separated families the option of being reunified either in the U.S. or their country of origin. And he said, we will dig out of the cruelty of the past administration.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
That's all it was. Let's just say their names for the record. Stephen Miller. Kirsten Nielsen. Miller was the architect of the plan. Sessions had a good deal of getting it implemented.
What about what Susan Rice did when she moved into Miller's office?
Please.
She burned sage and she's hung up Haitian artwork.
Yeah. It's so great. And if you feel sorry for Stephen Miller, his wife, remember the wife was sent to, oh, we've told this one before, but it's so worth telling again. She went to one of the detention camps, and she's a mom, and they said, have a look down there, and it'll soften you up and change your mind about Stephen's policy. And she said, when she came back, it didn't work. So she was absolutely able to see that, compartmentalize it, and move on with the, as the tubes once say, and try to enjoy life while you do the nasty things you must. So... that's getting righted bit by bit by bit. And I believe Miller will also be under scrutiny because what he did was a wild overreach.
Yeah.
And the cruelty contained in that, it has to be unconstitutional at the end of the day. Even to Amy Coney Barrett, perhaps. We shall see if her intellect is a deflecting wall of indifference. Is she somewhere between...
with all that experience under her belt.
Scalise and Thomas on the... Yeah. Oh, God. You know, as far as I know, global warming is controversial.
Yeah.
I believe she said that. She also said that if they canceled Pepe Le Pew, she wasn't going to go see Space Jam 2.
but are Jewish people with horns and tails shooting, causing forest fires with lasers from space?
Yeah, they are. My uncle worked on that. He was part of a very large Hebraic cartel Oh yeah, talk about that. That'll be good. But I had this really crappy joke I was going to do, but here we're flowing along pretty nicely. This was a clickbait headline that popped up on my computer. The largest glowing shark species discovered near New Zealand. It's the biggest bioluminescent vertebrate found on land or sea, comma, so far. And then there's a picture of an elusive, ephemeral, what was clearly supposed to be a deep, deep sea, so deep that the sea is black, and a glowing blue shark that looks so ghastly. Of course I clicked on it, and it's the New York Times, and you don't get any. I think I've already gone through my free article or whatever you get.
So no glowing shark
for
you.
No, I have to sign up to get it, and I'm not going to do it as long as Maureen Dowd and David Brooks are left on Earth. I love Charles M. Blow, and I love who's our Nobel Prize winning, the grumpy economist.
Paul Krugman.
Yeah, Paul Krugman. And obviously, there's a lot of entertaining. And as you always point out, the people who busted him on the Deutsche Bank.
David Enrich, Susan Craig.
They have a lot of great reporters. They also have an Olympic-sized douche waiting pool out there that there's a lot of people in.
The animosity, their terror of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, they put the story out. They tried to sink her, and also
they did everything they could.
They never ever used the word lie with 45, and they never called for his resignation. And then that was pretty bad. Let's talk about. So I didn't click on it, but I wanted to. And when I see the words, it's the biggest bioluminescent vertebrate found on land or sea so far. Not only do I feel cheated, but I feel like now you're just. You know what? You're cock teasing me. Don't say there's going to be a bigger one soon, and then I better get on this one now, and then I have to sign up for the Times, and have to read a Maureen Dowd column about how, they don't like what Kamala's wearing this week, and therefore the whole administration's worse than 45s.
Right.
Let's see here. What do you got there? Oh, yeah, well, let's do that one.
From the Bitter Southerner, they had an article called...
May I ask what the Bitter Southerner is? Is this a person we know?
Well, it's Tales of the South.
Oh, okay. You realize you just said from the Bitter Southerner.
Right? Well, that's what it's called.
I know, but if I don't know that there's a publication called the Bitter Southerner, it could have been a person you were referring to as a Bitter Southerner.
There was the anniversary of the Greensboro
lunch counter
when four black students sat down at the counter, mm-hmm. which was not going to serve them. And the man who is busing the counter is still around.
Right. He's in the picture. There he is.
And he was caught in the photo of the moment when they're all looking... Look at those guys. They look very studious.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're all college students.
Super raincoats.
Yeah.
And not being served, but sitting at the counter. The idea that was so provocative, it was in February of 1960. So this woman went and interviewed Sayaka Matsuka, went to the museum in Greensboro.
Mm-hmm.
He lives there nearby still, and he likes to drop by and talk to people about that day. He was only allowed certain jobs.
Right.
And...
Like cleaning up?
Right. He was...
Bussing tables?
The Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro. He was allowed to bus things and go upstairs. They weren't allowed to wait on customers.
Right.
And he couldn't believe that he was in the photo, and he's looking away from them, looking down, and she said, well, you know, what was going through your mind? Were you worried? And he said, I felt like I wanted to tell everybody. I was excited about it. It was a very exciting week. After his shift was over and he'd finished his closing duties, he caught a cab home and remembers telling the driver all about the young man who came into the store that day. As soon as he got home, he told his sister and then his brother-in-law.
Wow.
I did have to wrestle with it, he says. I was on the other side being paid by a company that was keeping me going, but all the same, time, I was kind of on their side. I was on this side, but I was rejoiced by the people on the other side. I felt like there's going to be change.
It's so awesome. I called you from there like 2 years ago.
Right.
We played Greensboro, and then the next night we played Birmingham and then Huntsville. We had a good old time. And I went to that museum. It's really fantastic. And there's a giant, well, not a giant, there's one of those street monuments with a big sign that commemorates that event. And then there was, of course, a terrible terrorist, just the violent shooting.
He said that everything in that town was segregated. It didn't bother me too much because my parents and people older than me was going along with that, and I felt like that was the way to go. That's what it was like for years. We were set in our own way. It wasn't until he saw the four that it dawned on him that things could be different. I just felt like that a change had come when these four guys were sitting there.
Wow. Also, it's a shady little lane, by the way. It's a very cute downtown street that it's on, with little diners and little tchotchke shops and I had a walk down there. The theater's on the street. It's just down the street from the...
And then very weirdly, after that became famous, they quietly desegregated the Woolworth counter. And then his boss asked him and three of his black coworkers to sit at the counter and eat.
Really?
Yeah. And he never ate there again. That was the only time. I mean, it was like a performance piece for Woolworths, I guess, to feel better about themselves.
Right.
And then there he is talking to kids who come into the museum. I love that he lives nearby and just drops in to tell everybody about it.
Yeah. By the way, a Woolworths was a giant chain of what they called in those days five and dimes. And so they had cheap articles, you know, like, but household goods and stuff too, and clothes and everything.
Yeah,
they really had everything. Yeah. Pencils.
Kind of a combination hardware store, grocery store.
Department-ish store. Uh-huh. But at a very cheap level.
Yeah, you could afford to eat.
Yeah. They had bought bags of candy and stuff like that, you know, really cheap bags of candy. And that lunch counter at the one in San Francisco was at the corner of Market and California, was it? It was right downtown, where the cable car turnaround was.
Well, wasn't it at Powell?
Powell, that's it. Powell and Market, where the cable car turnaround was. And
there was always a guy with an obnoxious religious placard yelling at us. And I would go there with the guys from Display, and we would sit at the counter because we could afford.
It was $2.25 for lunch.
Exactly.
You could get a grilled cheese sandwich, French fries, and coleslaw, and an iced tea or whatever for like that much money. And that's the 80s. It was cheap. It was a really good bargain.
And it was funny because you fought your way through the tourists and the angry guy, and then you go in there, and it was none of them were in there.
No, it was an oasis.
A little quiet.
It was an oasis of calm. And they really did have the fountain with the fountain drinks in it, and they really did wear paper hats, and they really did give you your drink in a cone, a paper cone that they put in a plastic holder.
Mm-hmm.
That was how you got served. It was like paper cups, and I ate there a bunch because – like I said, you could get a patty melt for like $2 or whatever. And the counter was quiet. There was, you know, but it was popular. And then, of course, the whole chain went out of business. Did we have a Woolworths in San Carlos? We had a Sprouse Reitz, which was another five and dime. And then there was a Woolworths down the road, I think, in Redwood City. I used to like going to the counter with my mom when I was little because it was, you know.
There's ice cream.
Yeah. I was going to say, the candy and ice cream scene at Woolworths made it always worth. Also, I used to go to the Macy's in San Mateo at Hillsdale, and they had a candy department there that we would always hit. And nonpareils, do you know those ones?
Oh.
The ones that have the white beading on them?
Yeah,
They're chocolate lozenges with white
sugar. Those are not for me.
No. And we get bags of nonpareils and then go to the book department and buy a Mad magazine book. Remember all the Mad books? And Boiling Mad and Revolting Mad and all those Mad books that were compilations of Mad magazines. Yeah, that was big stuff. And they cost like 60 cents. I know it sounds like it's the 30s, but a little paperback book like that was what? 60, 80 cents?
Mm-hmm.
They'd send the book club thing to your school. Remember that one? And you'd mark all the books you wanted.
I love doing that.
Me too. And then a couple weeks later, a big stack of books. Mm-hmm. You got a big... It was great. That's when I got Viking Adventure, which I thought was some high art.
There was some important decision making at break time. You know, were you going to have orange juice?
Right.
And how many books were you going to order?
How many would your parents allow you to? Because I always wanted to go batshit, and there was like, you know, you can get a few, but don't, you're not getting 20 or whatever. Although I always read all of them.
No.
Yeah, there was, you know, I would get like adventure books and Aztec books and, you know, that kind of jazz. The one that I talked about that someone gave me and I still have it somewhere is Viking Adventure. I tried to read it again. It's hilarious. It's about a young boy who goes on a questing trip with his uncle who's a Viking, and they, you know, they have to kill people and they find islands. And yeah, it's when I was
That's
like,
a hectic childhood.
When I was 10, I was like, I don't know how they came up with this. This is some, I don't know who wrote this, but wow. It was like Michener to me. I was, you know, I was bowled over by the Viking Adventure.
Another thing that I came across this week that I just thought was wild, an author and speaker named Erica Buddington wrote about it on Twitter, that she'd seen a building in Brooklyn and she wanted to know more about it. And she found out that it had been the home of the United Order of Tents, which was founded in 1867 by two formerly enslaved women, Annetta Lane and Harriet Taylor, and they formed an African-American Christian fraternal benevolent organization. It was exclusively female-owned, operated, and directed, and it was called the Tents after the Underground Railroad custom of providing tents for those escaping enslavement.
Mm.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, that's astonishing. Where were you reading that?
It was on Twitter, and I had to look it up, and
oh yes,
Annetta Lane was an enslaved woman who was also a nurse on a plantation, and they decided to form a group that would help other black women, and then they also had a home for the elderly that ran until at least 2002.
I was going to say, does it still exist?
I'm not sure if it is, because it's in more than one place.
Well,
so there may be, and it is a secretive organization,
yeah.
Because it was all about the banks won't lend you money, the people won't rent to you, you can't get a job. Mm-hmm. So there was a system within the system hidden to help those people who couldn't get ahead.
That's just fantastic.
Isn't it?
Here's another feel-good story. Kelly Loeffler, who ran for, she was the appointed senator by Brian Kemp, who was the one who rigged the election that beat Stacey Abrams. She was never elected to office. Her husband owns the stock exchange. Her husband owns the New York Stock Exchange. Her husband owns the New York Stock Exchange. She's a billionaire. You may remember her debate with the Reverend Raphael Warnock, where he made points about talking about people's needs of the state of Georgia, what they could improve in their lives, education, healthcare, and everything that he said, she responded with, "Reverend Warnock is a democratic socialist."
Right. She kept repeating
radicals,
that.
He's a radical socialist, which he isn't. He's a very pragmatic minister from, in fact, Martin Luther King's church, of which he was the minister of. And Dave Zirin, who writes for The Nation, is a terrific sports writer. And this is a great Women's History Month story for several reasons. Kelly Loeffler, as you know, by any measure, it should be the biggest story in sports. I'll just read the first couple sentences. A franchise owner runs a racist Senate campaign, throwing her own black players under the bus in the process. By the way, Kelly Loeffler, I buried the lead, owns the Atlanta Dream in the WNBA. What happened was she started to run for senator and became senator, her racist views were known. As the election progressed on, she had a real hard time keeping it civil and used a lot of, you know, she sucked up to 45 when he came down. Remember, she ran mm-hmm. down the tarmac to get him. Mm-hmm. She craved his endorsement. They had a super spreader event in Georgia, which had a terrible infection rate then. Then she said that Black Lives Matter was a terrorist organization. She owns a team that's peopled and coached by black women.
I loved when they wore the t-shirts
yeah.
supporting Warnock.
Yep, yeah. And in a league of black women. And So the team didn't like it, and she was openly racist about it the whole campaign. She really insisted that Antifa existed, that Black Lives Matter were terrorists, and that...
Where was she on Mr. Potato Head?
She thought that if you used a lighter a russet type, it was okay, but if you used a darker potato...
Say Yukon Gold would be better than...
Well, Yukon Gold would be better than a russet. Russets are a little dark and rough, and the Yukon Gold's a little smoother and has more yellowy cast to it. Lighter cast. So that's where we're going with this. One of the players takes the year off from playing ball to dedicate herself to social justice. The player asked to meet with Kelly Loeffler. She refused to, as Dave Zarin puts, respectfully engage with someone who disagrees with her for political reasons. After the franchise owner faceplants their election campaign, ending in ignominious defeat, the players' union, fans, and eventually the league pressures her to sell the club. She was made to sell the club.
God, that's great.
In the end, that would be the story, but the story is even better than this because sexism is a hell of a drug, as he says, and it's a damn shame. This is a story for the ages. The team... that she lost her team was Raphael Warnock. The team's the Atlanta Dream. The player who joined the ownership group after spending a year doing social justice is Renee Montgomery, and she's a star. I reached out to Montgomery. This is what she said. I'm excited to be able to continue my basketball career as the first former WNBA player to become a team owner and member of the leadership team for the Dream. My moments in Atlanta are continuing to build momentum in the community. I look forward to developing relationships that are mutually beneficial to Atlanta and the Dream. It's not known how much stake she has. The chief investor is a guy named Larry Gotzendiener from Newton, Mass. He's a real estate investor. But they've made her the team's VP, Renee Montgomery, and Susan Ebert, a real estate exec who works with Gardner. LeBron was the one who inspired her. When all this went down, during the hot summer, mm-hmm. he suggested, because you remember they got to a runoff and that forced both of them mm-hmm. to have to run again in that special election, that he would look into buying that team.
Wow.
Because Loeffler was such an avowed racist during the campaign. Who was the other? Purdue mm-hmm. was running campaign ads that had Ossoff, his opponent, the Jewish man, drawn like a 1930s Jew and yes. Nazi propaganda. So they really, really went.
And then didn't even show up at their debates.
Her entire team, as you pointed out, he debated alone. He debated an empty podium. They put up a podium that said and kept saying, well, Purdue's not here, and they'd show the podium. And then Loeffler appeared to have something in her ear that was telling her to say, because she seemed incapable of lateral thought.
She was just repeating the same phrases.
But you can't just say that someone's a radical democratic socialist over and over again and expect that to be an argument. Well, it didn't work, did it? She got trounced. And in a runoff that she should have blown them away. And that's why the Senate is the way it is today. Anyway, I just thought it was such a story that delighted me and lifted my spirits to the sky, because now the Dream has a new VP. And it's mm-hmm. a woman who's one of them, a former star. She had, you know, it's delightful.
Speaking of Warnock, the other day when it was the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, he tweeted a photo of himself, John Lewis, and the woman in the picture with him was Renona Clayton, who thankfully is still with us. But her bio is so amazing. She was the driving force behind the complimentary project, the International Civil Rights Walk of Fame, and the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta. She worked undercover for the Chicago Urban League,
this
investigating
like.
Employment discrimination before moving to Atlanta in 1965 to organize events for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She developed a deep friendship with Dr. King and his wife, Coretta Scott King. She coordinated the activities of Atlanta's African American Physicians and Doctors Committee for implementation. That project helped force the desegregation of all hospital facilities in Atlanta. As a journalist, she wrote a column for the Atlanta Voice, and in 1967, she became the first Black person in the South to host a regularly scheduled primetime TV talk show. And on that show, the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia appeared on her program. She began a dialogue with him that influenced him to resign from the Klan and renounce the organization.
Yes! I love this part of the story so much. He had a strike of conscience after he met her.
Yeah.
He couldn't support himself anymore after me. And by the way, she's what? 4 feet tall?
Yes.
She's a mighty mite.
In the photo, she's much smaller than John Lewis.
And John Lewis was, as you know, very tiny indeed. But she's a giant. And getting her own television show, talking the leader of the Klan out of being the leader of the Klan with by sheer persuasion is just like... Imagine he went home and he said, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it's like to leave.
Like, huh.
You can't leave the Klan. That's like leaving the mafia. They're mad at you.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So I just wanted to highlight her.
Zenona Clayton, still alive. It is International Ladies Day, as you know. Let's get to my shows and then we'll do Vernon Jordan and Bunny Wailer because I got was way more... Because Black History Month's every month.
Yes.
13th, this Saturday. Woody, hey, what you doing? Hey, what you doing? Proops is here. I want the Proops. You can't handle the Proops. Sorry, you weren't ready for that volume raise. Me and Ben Glebe are doing a G thing. That's Gamera versus Godzilla on Monster Island. This Saturday, 5 p.m. is when we tip off. We're going to have a lot of people from... in for Purim, so I'm pretty excited about that. And we got a VIP meet, or a VNPI. We're doing a VNPI meet and greet. I'm speaking bastard Viennese for the rest of the show. We are having a VNPI meet and greet after the show, and that will start approximately 6:30. I will read you what it says here. I've never read the website. Greg Proops of the Smartest Men in the World podcast, and Whose Line Is It Anyway misspelled. I should have read that. It's who is here. The way they've spelled it is who is line is it anyway. But it's a common mistake. And my name is actually Carson. I just changed it to Proops because Proops sounded less ethnic to me. It's a G thing. Proops, that's the 13th, right? And then I've got so many shows. I'm going to go through all of them here. The 19th is a stand-up show. With me. And I'll be performing not in the Porpoise of Fruititude, but in the Latitude of Platitudes. It's just adjacent to... We have a small bowling alley here. It's just two lanes. And our pin boy during this has been so sweet. I mean, you know, we tip him, but I'm not sure where he's eating and stuff. But he lives... Anyway, he lives on the in-law house that's out in the North 40. And yes, it's like the Ponderosa's North 40 on the show Bonanza. There's scrub oak everywhere, and there's a large man in a vest and a giant white hat named Hoss. So the 19th, our good friend Joel Nicole Johnson will be gigging with me. She will be the feature. I will be the H-liner. That's March 19th at 5 p.m. Why Joelle? Well, why not? One, she's family. Two, she's part of the Abortion Action Front. She's mm-hmm. an activist as well as a friend of ours. We met her doing it in Mississippi several years ago, doing the Abortion Action Front, which was then called the Lady Parts Justice League. In any case, they went to all these abortion clinics and really helped. They paint the place, buy furniture, raise money, bring food, help them against the...
And she was very composed dealing with those people screaming at her.
Right, the aunties. And so, yeah, she's not only is she an awesome woman, she's an active stand-up comedian. But what I was getting at was, for sentimental reasons, one is why I love you, for sentimental reasons, but two, it's the anniversary of we would have been in New York next year, and on the 20th, we were going to do a gig together in Rhode Island, Joel and I. So we're getting to do a gig together a year later. It's a virtual gig. It's not the awesome theater we were going to play in Rhode Island. And by the way, the gig was so close, we had both ordered our dinners. I'd sent her the
first
menu,
things first.
And it was Italian food, yeah. And she was like, oh, we're getting dinner. I'm like, yeah, they're giving us dinner at the theater before the show, so we got to get there at like 5 or whatever and eat dinner. Who's live? Anyway, it's March 20. I think I have 27th here. Let's just see what date it really is. I think I have March 28th. I keep getting the date wrong, and I really don't know why. And it's not there either. Okay. All right. Let's find a better link. I'm telling people to go to my website, and then I put a link in that's not that great. And I want to talk to the manager. Why should we come and see this, Greg? One, it's the great, great comedy, you know, of Ryan Stiles, me. Oh, poo. Joel Murray, Jeff Davis, Bob Durkach, our musical director. But our special, ask me about our special guests.
Who are your special guests?
Thank you for asking, Jennifer. Not only, last month we had Allison Tolman from Fargo, who's on a show now called Why Women Kill. But we had from Monty Python, Eric Idle. March 27th, Saturday. That's right, the 28th Sunday. I've got the date wrong and the link wrong on my site. Saturday, March 27th at 5 p.m. That's going to really push ticket sales, don't you think, by sending them to my site where it's wrong? It's at 5 p.m. our time. You can get it at House Seats Live. Don't go to whoslive.com. Somehow the thing's wrong. And I'll fix it on mine, so you can come to mine, gregproops.com. Our special guests are Gary A. Williams, who's hysterically funny on Whose Line Is It Anyway? And also we have the insanely awesome Lorraine Newman from the original cast of Saturday Night Live. Yeah, you heard me. And then not least, but lastly, you know him, you love him, our very good friend, the Drew Carey. So we have an all-star lineup for the show.
That's pretty good.
There's a lot of comic. And we're going to have a lot of schmoozing, a lot of good times, a lot of touching and feeling each other through the Zoom. I think it's a good time, and I think it's worth it. I don't know how much it is because I just went off the link, but it can't be that much. I think it was $7. It's not really very expensive. It's kind of a comedy bargone. I got to fix that link. Nowhere Comedy Club presents me, Greg Proops, the smartest man in the world, Proopcast, to celebrate the end of Women's History Month, an all-male show featuring a cishet guy, but he makes no case for it. It's at 5 p.m. We'll be doing that in the Porpoise of Fruititude. We're actually not recording this podcast tonight in the Porpoise of Fruititude. We're in Jennifer's lair of vanilla delight, and it's just amazing in here. I wish I could describe it to you. There's Rex Ray artwork everywhere.
Surprise.
There's a sign that says feminist as fuck. There's a painting of a wombat. Bops Maru is here.
And since Lawrence Ferlinghetti, his book is sitting there, can I just shoehorn in this comment that I forgot to add in when we were talking about him the other day. In the San Francisco Chronicle, a tribute to Lawrence Ferlinghetti, he said, "I'm there in spirit all the time of the bookstore." And then when he was asked how often he was in the shop late in life, he said, "As a poet, I don't deal in reality."
Just fantastic.
Isn't that great?
Speaking of non-reality, March 31st is the date. Oh, I see what the ticket prices are. It's 5 p.m. I'll do the podcast for like an hour and a half, and then there's a little VIP meet and greet afterward. Early bird tickets are $10. So that's not so bad, right? And then
it's a deal.
After, when it gets close to the date, like the day of, it's 15. VIP is 25 clams. And then there's something called VIP couples. Access to private meet and greet first. Oh, and you get my album. Oh, that's why we charge $50. Because you not only do you get two tickets.
This is all a surprise to you, isn't it?
I really need to promote myself better. And access to the private meet and greet after, which is good fun. Because I spend a lot of time with everybody. I chatted up. And then the first 25 get digital album downloads. Well, that's good. I don't know which album it is. I suspect it's The Resistance. And then there's a couples ticket and a group ticket. Oh, that's cute. There's another thing called Ticket Plus. You're throwing an extra few bucks to support the comedians. The reason why I think the show on the 31st and the show on the 27th are important, and I you know you're thinking why, is because I think a lot of people are going to have their stimulus checks by then, Jennifer.
And
I'm hoping the economy gets a big jolt, you know, and that everybody will have some bread, or at least the threat of some bread. Oh, the Who's Live show is 15 clams. 15 clams, Drew Carey, Lorraine Newman, Gary Williams, and all of us. So that's the 27th at 5 o'clock. Stand up on the 19th, and this Saturday is the G thing with Gamera and Godzilla, me and Ben Glebe. Let's do Bunny Wailer.
All right.
Because we haven't played any music forever, and I'm becoming mesmerized by the sound of my own voice. Bunny Wailer is wafted into the heavens on a cloud of Rastafarian soul spiritual smoke this week.
I wasn't ready for that.
No.
He was in his early 70s. I guess he had a stroke a couple of years ago, and he just went back in the hospital, and he didn't make it. He was the last of the Wailers.
Well, they were a bunch of different names. They were the Young Wailers, and they were they had a bunch of incarnations. Then they became the Wailers. Then finally, Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he sang the high part. Anyway, the Wailers met up, and Bob Marley was his oldest friend. Bob was like 2 years older than him. and they went to school together in St. Anne's Parish. And
his name was Neville O'Reilly Livingston.
Yeah, unbelievable. And he said he took the name Whaler because he was that serious about it. Anyway, they formed a bunch of different groups and then became Bob Marley and the Whalers. And him, Peter Tosh, and Bob Marley were the crux of the group until Peter and him left after several years. And Bob Marley, of course, went on till ever with his enormity. But they were a trio. And as I say, money sings the high part. But here's one that's unbelievably good. When they finally met, Chris Blackwell's when it all got... Mm-hmm. Got international superstar. That was abrupt. I didn't mean to do that either. I'm really making it happen tonight.
And I'm looking at all of his incarnations and his fashions.
I was going to say, one thing that's unbelievable
really
is his
cool outfits.
The first incarnation, they really look like the Miracles.
Yeah.
And this, you can hear when they do the woo, they have doo-wop group harmonies too. He said they love jazz and that's what they grew up on and that all American music, he said, till we started making it on our own, was what they listened to, you know.
Yeah.
Some of these outfits, stop on that one. He's got an enormous pipe full of ganja, a yellow Jamaican African vest, what appears to be that shirt has all the African colors and...
He's got medallions, he's got what appears to be tapestry trousers.
Yeah, the trousers look like a tapestry.
And then he's got reflective shades.
And his hair is
yellow.
In the wildest bun.
And
yeah, that's kind of the extraterrestrial shaman look going on there. But go back to that one of the Whalers where they're smoking cigarettes.
God.
That's the super hot rock stars.
Cool. Patchwork jeans and kind of army gear.
Two-tone high-top shoes.
A lot of hats are essential.
Oh, and felty, quilty, welty hats. He's always was ripped and whipped thin and I think stoned all of the time.
There is a wild interview from 2011.
Yeah.
You thought it was a different... It was from GQ. It was John Jeremiah Sullivan. He went to Jamaica to interview... Buddy Whaler, and the process was mysterious.
Yeah.
The guy.
Nobody had a sign at the airport.
No,
right?
He had a sign, but not for him.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean,
yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, maybe trust issues.
Yeah.
And
probably rightly so.
But, yeah, exactly. And he lived in a very poor part of Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finally get to his house the next day, there's a sign out that says, I won't be back. Ja B won't be back until March something.
Mm-hmm.
Except it's July at this point.
Yeah.
But I do recommend that because you and I remember the article from...
Yes, I do. I read it in a magazine and brought it home and gave it to you. I read it on a plane.
Because it really is exciting.
And he gets him high. He gets the reporter high, is my recollection. The Whalers, of course, he left after a while and had an own fantastic solo career. He won a bunch of Grammys. And here's one from Dreamland. From Blackheart Man, it's called Dreamland. Thank you.
across the sea.
How lovely and lyrical.
It's very soothing.
Isn't it?
He's
a wonderful performer.
Yes. He said, live for yourself and you will live in vain. Live for others, you will live again.
I mean, he stayed there. He didn't move to Canada or something. And he is so elemental. And we've had so many reggae people go. It's just been
It's tragic.
Brutal.
It's really tragic. I mean, 73... was too young.
He was in a... this is another one off this very album. This is the kind of dreamy one, and then... he's very powerful in that it's not as... it's a different bag than the Wailers. And it, as one critic said, it gets a lot accomplished. He's powerful in his melody and his lyrics. Here, let's listen to what's called Blackheart Man. This is the title. If I don't get the wrong key.
She can't hit that hard man, she red. I said don't run near him. She can't hit that hard man, she red. Or even lions fear him. She can't be black heart man, little children. I said don't go near him. She can't be black heart man, children. Or even liars fear him.
Dead catchy, right?
For such a long time
that is filled with fear.
Oh, making reggae an international superpower.
Yeah, and he's one of the ones that did. I only wanted to touch on this briefly because he is swirling in the heavens. But Peter Tosh was the other member of the band, and it doesn't seem fair that we should hear Bob Marley without hearing Peter Tosh as well, and Bunny Wailer. Here we go. Peter Tosh had a cracking solo career after he left the Wailers, too.
Yes, he
yes, he did say Babylon and Ganja.
No.
They're all devoted Rastafarians, the entire enchilada. Bunny Wailer will be missed. We'll pick him up in the next life. He did so much in this life. What are you going to do, Vernon Jordan now, or are we... what is happening here? Want to talk about him?
Sure.
Or what do you got there?
Well, I was just going to add that...
oh, please. It was
after Bunny Wailer had been given one of the highest and rarest orders by the government of Jamaica, the Order of Merit. You know, you can't overstate the importance of these people on music internationally. There's a nice tribute in the Jamaica Gleaner One of the themes of Bunny Wailer's music was repatriation. And so where he's going to rest is an important factor in Jamaica. The government recognized his contribution to Jamaican music again in 2019 with an award. It's been such a rough year.
Oh, golly.
For reggae artists, jazz artists.
Yeah.
Baseball. Yeah.
Yeah, it has been amazingly rough. But it's been rough for everyone. We're still here and we're still pulling through. Vernon Jordan is schmoozing in the heavens, is what Vernon Jordan's doing. Because he was one of the great figures in the civil rights movement and also in Washington. And he was dead close with Hillary and Bill.
He was called the first friend.
Yep. If you remember the 90s at all, you'll remember Vernon Jordan because he was often with Bill Clinton. And
he'd been friends with Bill Clinton since the 70s. Because of their shared southern background and childhood poverty.
Yes. He was the secretary for the Georgia NAACP. He was executive director of the United Negro College Fund. He headed the National Urban League, becoming the face of Black America's modern struggle for jobs and justice for more than a decade. He was nearly killed when a racist shot him in 1980.
With a rifle. Yeah. With a rifle.
And then he went into business and politics. Everybody knew him. And John Lewis and C.T. Vivian passed late last year.
Yeah.
And Vernon Jordan.
C.T. Vivian's memoirs come out next week.
Do they really?
Yeah,
oh,
they
my
do.
Goodness.
I came across this, an NPR article about Vernon Jordan. He was part of the legal team in 1961 that helped desegregate the University of Georgia. He escorted the school's first two Black students past a hostile crowd on their first day.
Yeah, he's 6'4", by the way. He moved to Arkansas, went into private practice, and then I guess he met Bill about 5 years after that. He was at Fort Wayne, Indiana, and a guy shot him with a hunter's rifle outside his hotel. Jimmy
it's
Carter
so
came
ghastly.
To visit him, and he said, and this is what's astonishing, "I'm not afraid and I won't quit." By the way, this guy who did it targeted Blacks and Jews in a cross-country killing spree for 3 years.
Oh, my God.
He was never prosecuted in Jordan's case, but was executed for another slaying. So the whole white supremacy is new and different. Isn't that different? I want to do... He wrote a book, of course, called Vernon Can Read, a memoir.
Exclamation point.
Yeah, Vernon Can Read.
Read.
Yeah. He was... Because he was an international lawyer and he sat on the boards of so many important things, he was really influential. But my favorite story, is it in here? The Joe Scarborough one? It was in a different story. I'm not a big fan of Joe Scarborough, but at least he had the decency to admit 45 was awful before the end, I suppose. In any case, the story is he was first doing his little morning talk show and Vernon Jordan got in the elevator with him. And everybody knows who Vernon Jordan is, and Joe Scarborough had been a congressperson. He said, "Son, show some respect to your guests and put on a tie." And he went, "When Vernon Jordan tells you to put on a tie, guess from then on I've worn a tie every day." Because I think he was imposing, and also the schmooziest schmoozer in Washington. He absolutely held court everywhere he went. And apparently he had really intimate dinner parties with never more than like 8 people, so that he could really get the story from everyone. He was a source of information, and he knew what everyone else was doing, and he did it the old-fashioned way by literally shaking hands and meeting everyone and having these dinner parties. And of course, he sat on so many boards, and he was at the head of so many things.
Right.
It opened
so
all the doors to him.
Yeah.
So he's kind of a gigantic part of American history, especially the last 50 years. And it's, again, the civil rights movement. But then he was 85. So I will take the triumph of that. And I will say what he said that we must all take on board. "I'm not afraid and I won't quit. Vernon Jordan is an irreplaceable part of American history.
Yes, I was just looking at a photo of he's making Obama laugh there at Howard University.
You can see how tall he is when he's standing next to Obama. when you see pictures of him and Hillary, you really get an idea. Bill and him are, he's taller than Bill,
yes.
And Bill's tall.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about how tall he was.
Right.
But he didn't have an official role with the Clinton administration, but he certainly was an unofficial advisor.
Yes.
I mean, he'd run every giant organization you could run by that point. He'd been a lawyer. He knew everyone.
Like you say, he's schmoozing.
Yeah, there's no one that was out of his influence, basically, as a politician, particularly Obama, Clinton, Hillary, Bill, and the like.
He also was the first to produce a State of Black America because he was sick of the crisis facing Black Americans being ignored.
Right. Where did he go? Oh, he went to school in Indiana.
And then Howard.
Wow. Let's talk about Ralph Peterson and then perhaps fuck off into this good night.
There's Ralph Peterson Jr. was as Jazz Time says, a beloved musician and educator who was a messenger in many more ways than one. He was famously in Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, along with Terrence Blanchard, who he recorded with later. He went on to have his own band. He recorded 23 albums of his own, but he was also a drummer on 100 or more albums by others, including Terrence Blanchard. And he also taught at Berklee College of Music and other places, but he was known as a really powerful educator and supporter of younger performers. He faced, this is from Jazz Times, he faced down adversity several times. He battled an addiction. He developed diabetes. He had two bouts with cancer. And he said, I'm confident that 70% of Ralph Peterson is equivalent to 150% of most people. That's not me patting myself on the back. It's just the truth.
He also was a drummer with Art Blakey in a band where Art Blakey was the drummer.
Was the drummer.
So how do you do that?
He said, in the biblical sense, sitting at the right hand of the Father, who Art Blakey.
Art Blakey.
Right? He through the messengers, he met trumpeter Terrence Blanchard and saxophonist Donald Harrison and would go on to play with their quintet. And he really had this hard bebop sound from that background and went on to, what is it? It's not something that I do because I want to hawk my wares enough to become flavor of the month. I've been flavor of the month. He also had a martial arts studio.
Of course. He's awesome. Wait till you hear some of this. This one's off Shade. This one's called Shade of Jade. It's from the Fotet Augmented. He had his own quartet for ages, and you'll dig it. Thank you. wild. Pretty wild, right?
Isn't it? This is from the press of Atlantic City. They quoted an article about him in the 90s in the New York Times. It's music that revolves around richly ambiguous harmonies and shifty mercurial melodies. Difficult as it is to play, Mr. Peterson and his group rekindled the style's sense of risk and triumph. And about his teaching, he touched so many students at Berkeley, and not in a superficial way, but in a deep way. They were like disciples of Ralph. They became very attached to him. He was always finding spaces in the music that create excitement.
Was he in Roy Hargrove's band, too?
He played with Roy Hargrove.
Wow. Well, Roy Hargrove went a little too soon. You can tell that this swings furiously. But if this one was too esoteric, though, as you noticed, it slotted nicely into the groove very soon here. Try this one on for size. This one's off an album called Subliminal Seduction. It's Trials of Trust and Treachery.
Interestingly, his dad was the city of Pleasantville's first...
Pleasantville, yeah.
Pleasantville was the city's first black police chief and its first black mayor.
Wow.
Yeah. And he came up in a family of drummers. His grandfather played drums, and so did four of his uncles.
Wow. That's a lot of drumming.
Right?
No wonder he's such a master.
No one could get to another instrument
Complete.
And it's sort of interesting, like Milford Graves, the combination of drumming, martial arts, dealing with his illness, and being an educator
at the same time. As you can tell, he's in a different bag on every... Super swinging. And what a sense of humor. Shade of Jade. Trials of Trust and Treachery. And I sit on the right side of God, who art Blakey.
One of his fellow performers said, you have to be strong as a musician yourself. It's like hopping on a train and you just go when you play with Ralph Peterson.
Wow.
By the way, he accomplished all that, and he was only 58 years old.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, on that note, yeah, he was only 58. It is to be mourned, but you can see him if you look up in the night sky. I've been the smartest man in the world, and I thank you. Jennifer's been the smartest woman in the world, and she thanks you.
Goodbye.
Right? Hello and goodbye. Good night and good luck. May every page you turn be a satchel page. May every bell that rings for you be a cool papa bell. And if you have to buy bonds, make sure they're Julian bonds. I wish you nothing but peace and love.